Hey there, this is the Alliance for the Future podcast, your top source for informed AI optimism. Today I'm speaking with Dean Ball. He is a research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center and the author of The Hyperdimensional Substack. We discuss the differing advantages China and America have in AI, the reasons why America stands to benefit much more from open source, the possible cybersecurity risks with the adoption of AI, a classical liberal framework for regulating AI, and why long time horizon predictions struggle to get an accurate picture. If you enjoy the podcast, please give us a subscribe and let a friend know, either in person or online, and give Dean's Substack a read in the link below. You can also support us at affuture.org/donate, and that's also our website for any more information you'd like to find. Without further ado, here's Dean Ball. Great to be speaking with you, and the occasion for today is your new article in National Affairs, How to Regulate Artificial Intelligence. That sounds a bit scary, but let's dive into it. What is the goal of regulating artificial intelligence?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. I wrote the article fundamentally to make the point that because artificial intelligence is a general purpose technology that will suffuse a huge amount of human activity, it's already regulated in many ways by the laws we already have. My point about how to regulate artificial intelligence is maybe there are some specific laws that you want to pass for artificial intelligence. We can get into that. That's an interesting debate to have. But we shouldn't think that there's no regulation of AI, because of course there is. Many of the crimes that people are worried about with AI, many of the risks people are worried about, are things that are already unlawful. And so the question is not so much, do we need to pass new laws? It's how can law enforcement scale its response or tailor its response to potentially new avenues of crime through enabled by AI?
Right. And this might seem obvious to people who deal with policy every day, but what are some of the ways in which artificial intelligence is already regulated? That might sound surprising to some people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, there's many of the things people talk about. Let's just get into some specifics, you know, deepfakes, things like that. Defamation and libel are already crimes. Fraud is already a crime. Cyber crime is called a crime because it's already, you know, codified in statute. It's illegal to, to steal people's digital property, regardless of what tool you use. So just because you did it with AI doesn't make it a different crime. In the same way that when the internet came about or computers came about, there were many new ways to commit crime. And yet most of the misconduct most of the misconduct in the world has been already anticipated by the legal system that we already have.
Right, right. And I think that many technological fights in the past have been about how laws that already exist will apply to these technologies in the future. Maybe you can see, you know, New York Times versus OpenAI as one extension of that. But yeah, that doesn't seem to be the approach in DC right now. It seems to be a much more, quite frankly, like ham-fisted approach.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's a lot of different proposals going around DC and Sacramento and other places these days, but a lot of what you hear is a desire to create a centralized agency that would regulate frontier models. And that to me seems like a total mess, just a total epistemic mess, because there's not a department of the internet that regulates downstream usage of the internet. There's not a department.
Right. And for the audience, what's a frontier model?
Oh, of course. Yeah. A frontier model is an AI model that is sort of at the peak of capabilities and usually computing power and things like that. Think GPT-4, Claude 3, models like that.
Right. And are they defining this simply by some kind of research utility, economic utility, parameter size, training time?
Yeah, the question of how you define a frontier model for the purposes of, you know, there's kind of the colloquial definition, the state of the art might be performance on benchmarks, just sort of one subjective experience with the model. In the law, it seems as though the direction that lawmakers, at least in the US, are going is defining frontier models based on the amount of compute required to train them. So the Biden administration has 10 to the 26 flops. Of course, the problem with that is that compute is a resource that increases exponentially, and algorithmic improvements can make models more efficient, can make training more efficient. So, 10 to the 26 flops is a level of compute that right now only a few very large companies can reach. But in the future, if things continue to go as they have in the past, that amount of compute will be much more accessible in the relatively near future. So these compute thresholds over time will cover a much broader range of models unless they're increased.
Right, right. You can imagine an older day compute law saying, you know, if you have more than 1 megabyte of RAM, this is in fact state of the art.
That seems huge at one point.
Right, exactly. Or we could go even lower, you know, 64 kilobytes.
Yeah.
And the problem of this, for people who don't really know about it, is that this is a moving target. This changes as time changes. And, you know, a law that might, you know, at least on its face be supposed to only regulate state of the art now suddenly interferes with everyone's day to day.
Right. I think Bill Gates at one point in the 90s or the early 2000s said something along the lines of, no one will ever need a computer with more than 10 megabytes of RAM or something like that. I forget exactly what
Don't
quote me exactly, but said something along those lines. And of course, what happens is that, as computing power increases, we find new ways to use them.
Yeah, so there's market exploration. People figure out more things. They figure out how to use these things. This sounds like a good story, right? So what are people worried about? Why are people worrying about, you know, the internet too?
Well, I think there's a few different ways you can, there's a few different ways you can come at this. I guess in broad strokes, there's two categories of people, to put it in a stylized way. There are the people that worry that AI models have an inherent risk to them. They may, attain sentience, consciousness, or otherwise compete with humans for resources. And ultimately that competition is one that we will lose. And so we have to either centralize highly the development of very, very capable AI systems, or simply not do it at all. I think someone like Eliezer Yudkowsky would probably say, we shouldn't build these systems at all. And then, there's people that are more worried about human misuse of the technology. And this ranges from everything from, spreading misinformation, which is a super complex, hard to define word that has been quite politically coded, all the way up to designing novel bioweapons using AI. So those are the risks that people are worried about.
And is there any credibility to those claims?
So the first category, the sort of inherent risk idea, it's a debate. It started out with as thought experiments on websites like Less Wrong, and places.
I just hate that term. Like, here is the thing with like a quote unquote thought experiment. It's not an experiment. You're not getting any data. It's not an observation of the real world.
Yeah,
it's literally, a made-up scenario.
Thought exercise might be a better word.
Sure.
And, you know, different people are persuaded to different degrees by that kind of argument. My general view is that banning the development of a very promising general purpose technology is quite a radical step. And if we're to take that step, we should do that with as much empirical evidence as we possibly can muster to support it. Now, the AI doom people would say, by the time there's empirical evidence, it'll be too late, and we'll all be dead. I don't buy that. I don't buy that. The other thing about the inherent risk viewpoint is that a lot of these arguments were developed prior to the deep learning revolution, which started, you know, around 12 years ago, and so they were developed when the technology was much more of an abstraction, and it was kind of imagined that these advanced AGI systems would operate in kind of a realm of pure reason, could just simply outreason humans in profound ways. That's not actually, you know, the most promising path right now to advanced AI systems doesn't really look like that. Maybe it'll increasingly come to resemble that over time. But right now, LLMs, if they have reasoning abilities at all, they're coming from being trained on an enormous corpus of human writing, human output.
Especially with some of these post-training techniques that perhaps we'll talk about later, such as RLHF or DPO, sure, reinforcement learning by human feedback or direct preference optimization, that there's a danger of sort of the opposite, right? That it becomes too attuned to the human consensus. Absolutely. That it's too unwilling to challenge the status quo, particularly, you know, or like we would be concerned about this when the status quo is wrong, which it often is throughout history, not even just in the most obvious political ways, but also in just about, you know, factual matters. People can look back in history and see time and time again that really non-controversial, in our eyes, right, in our times, non-controversial, plain scientific facts have been obscured by the crowd. And the continuation of this pattern is something that worries me a lot more than the sort of, you know, hypothetical concerns.
Absolutely. No, I think if the aim of developing AGI, whatever, some people debate that term, but you know, very capable AI systems, if the aim of doing that, or one of the important aims, is to investigate the universe and discover the nature of reality more richly, to your point, we know from the past that scientific advancements have not always necessarily corresponded with human preferences. I don't think quantum mechanics corresponds with pretty much anyone's preference, and yet it is how it works. So that will become an increasingly important issue as we, you know, if the goal is to build super intelligence, one would hope intuitively that it disagrees quite a bit with the conventional wisdom that humanity holds.
There's sort of a kind of tragedy here, right? Where we want something much, much more capable of science than us, but we don't necessarily want it to tell us that we've been wrong about science all of these years, that would actually be quite a gut punch. But yeah, but that's exactly what we're trying to build. And that'll hopefully lead to far better drugs, far better transportation, maybe space transportation, so on. Anyways, let's move on to some of the more concrete worries that people are trying to legislate against. So that may be, if I remember correctly, you brought up biotechnologies. People might use this for biowarfare. People might use this for other kinds of AI weapons, for misinformation. Is there anything else I missed?
Those are the big ones that I think I mentioned. There's obviously many more one could imagine. I mean, basically all kinds of malfeasance are possible with a general purpose technology. Think about the ways one can misuse electricity or computers. Quite a few.
Right. This is something worrying that I saw, is like the classification of quote unquote dual use technologies. And to me, if this is set as a precedent, then, you know, if the idea that large language models such as ChatGPT are some kind of, you know, military adjacent technology in the way that this report makes it seem, then that could be applied to just about everything you own. Could be applied to computers for sure. You know, definitely people use computers in warfare. It can be used to really any kind of electronics, as you said. It can be true of plastics. People use plastics in the military, certainly. Absolutely. Right. The way in which dual use is or is kind of stretched to wrap around AI, you know, it basically already wraps around, if not can be stretched to wrap around, like pretty much everything else in your life. And that's something that I find very worrying.
I completely agree. Something I often say is it a department of AI is like a department of metallurgy. It's too low in the tech stack, really, to be useful for regulation. Instead, what you should be doing is thinking about downstream uses that we do or don't want to regulate. There are a number of concerns. You know, one of the things that I find so interesting about this whole AI conversation is that AGI is seen as such a world-changing, transformative technology that it invites people to impose kind of their own idealized worldview on what happens afterwards, because it's kind of there's kind of AGI and then there's haze, there's fog about what happens after that. And so everyone wants to impose, you know, their own worldview. So there's libertarians who think it'll become a libertarian paradise, and there's you know, people that want state control of things that think that that's what we'll need. But the reality is that it'll probably be, you know, probably dissatisfy and satisfy everybody in different ways.
It's interesting, right? There are like two types of people. There are who kind of fantasize about the outcome. There's the people who think it will be utopia, and there will be the people who think it's dystopia, right? And this is maybe much more downstream of their disposition than downstream of their, you know, factual understanding.
Yes. And I think it is so important in these conversations, and will become increasingly important, I think, to really understand the technology at a fairly deep level. You know, not every single person needs to, you know, have an opinion on DPO versus PPO or, you know, whatever. Like we don't, it's not like every policymaker needs to be that deep in the weeds, but understanding how these things work, you know, and not just at a technical level, but also the economics, is important, I think, to crafting good regulation. It's not helpful for policymakers to enter the conversation and just say, we're going to pass a law that says this has to go well, according to us. That doesn't help anyone. That doesn't advance our knowledge. It doesn't give us new tools to actually make it go well. It just creates more confusion in my mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you talked about, or you mentioned AI weapons. What are like the real threats of AI weapons? Does China have better AI weapons than us?
It does seem as though China is more advanced on certain aspects of AI that can definitely relate to weapons. Surveillance, first of all. I think edge compute for like cameras to do facial recognition, gait analysis, you know, things like that. That is seems to be something where the Chinese are much further along, not just in the technology, but in the diffusion.
Yeah, and for the audience, I think this is a important clarification. A lot of these machine learning technologies are not just language models. They're not just ChatGPT. They're not just taking in text and trying to basically process that text. But instead, they're either, you know, these statistical inference tools, given someone's data, you know, how likely are they to have, you know, certain other traits? How certain are they to, say, be violating these laws within China, for example, right? Or you mentioned gait analysis, you know, just given how someone is walking, you know, this is most seen at airports, given how someone is walking, what are the likelihood they're carrying, you know, some kind of explosive, those are the kind of utilities that we're talking about. And these are other things that you can do with the same types of patterns of statistical analysis that that are used in machine learning.
So there are some areas where it would seem that China is ahead, or at least matches us. It looks like on language modeling, the U.S. has a pretty decisive lead, at least at this moment. You know, we'll see when it comes to warfare. I mean, a lot of that also is just about, it's really an institutional question between the PLA, the Chinese army, and the Department of Defense in the U.S. Which of those institutions will be more receptive to new technology? And there are really interesting questions about exactly how that works, and you know how institutions adopt new technology.
Do we know? Is it like completely fog of war? So we know that on a research level, China is better at these like non-language statistical techniques. Like, what about missiles? Are AI missiles, you know, automated missiles, better than China's automated missiles?
I think a lot of it is kind of unknown. And unfortunately, you know, the only real way to know would be to put it to a live test, which would be an armed conflict, which of course none of us want to do. But I suspect that it is uneven, and that there are areas where the US has a substantial lead, and there are areas where the Chinese do. Certainly,
sure. The Chinese. Which areas?
So when you, this isn't an army thing necessarily, but you can look on social media for you know, the drone shows that occur over Chinese cities, which are these very, very intricate sort of dances of drones that take place, where they'll form dragons and the dragons will fly around and things like that. And you know, that's a demonstration of some pretty powerful technology. This isn't AI in particular, but China is known to have more advanced missiles than we do, specifically hypersonic missiles. Unknown how useful hypersonic missiles actually will be in conflict. But I think it's very much undetermined right now. And one thing that is heartening to see as an American is that there is a budding group of new defense-minded startups, companies like Anduril, that are building kind of at a very rapid pace AI-enabled, software-defined weapons that you know, I think will be quite useful. But my guess would be, without knowing the specifics, my guess would be that AI and some of the hardware capabilities that are not really directly related to AI, but will be helped by AI, complement AI, will profoundly change the nature of warfare. So I think it's very much an open question. And the real, you know, determining factor there will be, how open is the Department of Defense and the US government more broadly to incorporating AI? And one of the worries that I have, for example, with the Biden executive order, is that they're essentially imposing regulations on government in its use of AI. So if government wants to use a language model or you know, some other form of machine learning, it has to you know, perform an equity analysis and multi-stakeholder committee and things like that can slow stuff down. One of the things I think people don't appreciate, including a lot of sort of classical liberal, libertarian-minded people, is that it's not actually just our economy in the US that's overregulated. Government itself is also overregulated. And that's why it's very hard for government to get things done, because its own activity is quite stringently regulated.
Right. There's this conception of the bureaucrat as kind of enjoying the paperwork, right? Wanting to impose more paperwork. But actually, in many cases, that's not true. Maybe there's some fraction of bureaucrats that are like that, but I know many people who work in civil service and want to do a good job, want to, you know, even from a completely kind of unrelated to AI, which is more of an emerging technology, more of a unknown, wanting to get more energy permits approved, for example, get yes. more development grants approved, get more science grants approved, right? And wants to, you know, of course, make sure it's valid, make sure that the grantees are not committing fraud, anything like that. But at the end of the day, you have to put up with a lot of this busy work that they don't want to be doing, that they'd rather, you know, that they themselves would rather pick up the pace, but that's not something that's under their control right now.
Yeah, look at what's going on right now with the Chips and Science Act, where you know, Congress in 2021, I believe, appropriated $55 billion for the construction of semiconductor manufacturing facilities and other things relating to semiconductors all over the U.S. So this money was appropriated 2.5 years ago, and you know, very little of it has actually been dispersed. And the reason for that relates to lots and lots and lots of process regulation over the activities of government itself. So these are the kinds of things that I view as like quintessentially nonpartisan issues, because as long as you believe that government should exist and has a role to do something, we want it to be able to do those things well and efficiently. And these are the kinds of regulations that I'm talking about that can really slow that down.
You know, this is something that Ezra Klein agrees with. This is something that Tyler Cowen agrees with. You could think of the 90s to 2000s. Maybe it already started, but this is when it kind of burgeoned. It is the kind of process revolution, right? Or maybe even earlier. Maybe Nixon was the real, you know, EPA was Nixon, right? And NRC. There's roots of it earlier as well. But, yeah. You know, maybe in terms of sentiment, you know, peak proceduralism was like 2000s, even if a lot of the policies were already in place. And then, you know, the kind of elite ideology on both sides of the aisle turned against it. Actually, process is less important. You should be focusing on the 10 or 20% of the process that actually, you know, gets rid of fraud and, you know, checks for those safety concerns. And then 80% of this is just, you know, kind of political bargaining stuff and is actually unnecessary. It is sort of a mainstream bipartisan narrative nowadays.
Yeah, no, it is. I think it is. And I think the important lesson to take away from that is that at least as far as, you know, kind of elite discourse goes, this change of opinion about proceduralism is essentially bipartisan, as you say, and yet we can't do much about it. It's seemingly, you know, there's been some efforts to reform some of this, whether it's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, you know, the different pieces of this, but it's been very, very hard. Because there are interest groups, regulatory capture takes place, and there's also a whole complex of nonprofits and academic institutions and other groups that crop up to continue supporting the status quo. The right wants it gone so you can build pipelines, and the left wants it gone so you can build wind turbines. But neither is possible, and there's not a lot you can do about it, it would seem. So that is... you know, fixing Congress and the dysfunction in Congress is a totally separate issue. It's an important one, but it's also just a reality that we have to contend with as we contemplate legislation related to AI, because history would suggest that we're going to get one shot at this. And if we do NEPA for AI, that's going to be with us forever. And it may fundamentally impede progress in pretty much one of the only areas of our economy that has delivered sustained cost reduction and progress and technical progress over the last 30, 40 years. You know, really one of the only ones is the digital economy, computers.
And the thing that I worry about is that the downstream consequences of regulating AI are, as you said, regulating every part of the industry, right? If you have these broad permissions on AI, whether that's because, you know, they're theoretically, you know, the AI that you're using in your, you know, in your factory machinery or in your spreadsheets or in your, you know, diagnosis clipboard is actually, you know, dual use military technology, that this becomes an excuse to regulate and to fish for outcomes in almost exactly every micro area of life, right? Yeah. That once that becomes a pattern, and you see this with NEPA, right? The fact that the process can be used to obstruct things means that it will be used to obstruct things. And it's not really ideological. The things that it's obstructing are like solar panels and like wind turbines. It's like, you know, left on left lawfare, but it's, you know, it's worse than that, right? It's not really ideological. It's not really leading to any one side winning. It is just the incentive that it creates, all basically like all on its own, that if you create this incentive to kind of stall in the process, that, you know, any vocal objector will basically be granted some kind of additional advantage, which is functionally what NEPA does. Then this expands into the area of regulation, right? It sort of is a slow process of optimization, where the thing being optimized is like the maximum amount of obstruction in between steps.
Yeah, yeah, and the problem is that once you create that infrastructure to regulate, you know, effectively the use of computers, you might say at the very beginning, it's, you know, the frontier models only, and it's OpenAI and DeepMind and Anthropic and companies like that. But once you've created that legal and institutional infrastructure, it becomes very tempting to start applying it to other things. And we've seen that. We've seen that consistently, that the administrative state in this country takes the broadest possible view, interpretation of its own statutory powers. So there are examples of laws that were passed during our lifetimes, you know, in the last 20 years, that where we know exactly what the intention of the creators of the law, what their intention was. And now we have administrative agencies that are trying to interpret that same law way beyond what the original intention was. We'll see. You know, it looks like the Supreme Court might be very soon about to put some impediments on that. But that's just been the general trend. And I think as a general rule, you know, if you give an administrative agency power, it's going to interpret its powers within the fullest extent of the law. And so you have to be cognizant of that when you're creating regulation. And so I tend to think that regulating conduct and physical devices is something that, you know, the government does, or you know, drugs or things like that. But software is really a different beast. It's really an instantiation of knowledge. And in that sense, I view software as being a form of speech, a form of expression. And so regulation of it is just very, it not only is it constitutionally problematic, it's just very difficult to enforce, and just very, very complicated. So it's not a road that I think we should be going down if we can avoid it at all.
Right. I want to get a bit into that, because I think, yeah, there's one side of this where the lawyer, you know, finishes his argument, sits down, waits for the verdict of the judge, and I think in this case that verdict would be in your favor, that, you know, the precedent is that software is protected by the First Amendment. But there's all sorts of ways to you know, go through that and to try to affect AI indirectly, whether that's through, you know, restrictions of AI hardware or through kind of licensing agencies on the corporate entities, right? There are ways that circumvent the legal argument in ways that, at least to me, make the kind of spirit of the law just as important as the you know, letter of the law here. Mm-hmm. So, right, I want to address that. Why is this distinction important? Right, why is software different than either hardware or these other physical technologies? What impact does that have? What impact is that distinction on people's lives?
I think the important distinction is that software is it's knowledge. In a certain sense, it's knowledge about how to do a specific thing with a computer and its instructions. You can think of it like a recipe, or you can think of it like a book. But I think that's just quite different from a physical device that you're selling on the market. For one thing, software is non-rivalrous, like all knowledge. And what that means is that if I know a fact and you know a fact, there's not a limited supply of facts, of that specific fact, right? Everyone in the world can know it, and we can, you know, there can be new people born who also learn it, and we're not going to run out of it. Same with software. That gets to the feasibility point. Before you get into principles about the Constitution and, you know, the Enlightenment and things like that, I think just from a feasibility perspective, that makes it very hard to control. We also happen to have a global instant communications network for transmitting knowledge, the internet, which makes it even harder. It's just not entirely clear to me. For example, you know, if you want to get into like open source software, open source AI, which is something a lot of people worry about quite a bit, it's not clear to me how you would stop something like that from existing if you wanted to. You could harm it considerably. You could deal a very severe blow to it through law, because most people who build open source software are lawful actors, and they will try to comply with the law. But the people who are trying to use AI to build a bioweapon probably don't care about NIST's AI risk management framework. Like, they probably are not that interested in whether or not they comply with that. So by pathologizing the development of AI, particularly open source AI, you're kind of just guaranteeing that it's just criminals. You're kind of...
My takeaway from that is that all of these factors about software, the non-rivalrous factor, the fact that you can share it over the internet, is a kind of force multiplier, right? Is a kind of scaling factor where if you think it's bad, then you think it's 10 times as bad or 100 times as bad. And if you think it's good, then it's 100 times as good or you know, 1,000 times as good. It's not very clear to me that if you're already assuming it's bad and you're taking a regulatory position, that this will lead you to not think that it's bad. I don't think it's actually persuasive to anyone, right? It just makes people double down.
If you were looking to the future at the dawn of the computing, the personal computing era in the 1980s, the idea that open source software would undergird most of, not maybe not most, but a huge amount of the digital economy would be totally alien to you. It's just not the way you would, the way that open source has worked out is not the way anybody would have predicted. And the benefits just have manifestly outweighed the risks, at least so far. If you really understand why it is that open source software has been so useful, whether for security purposes or for economic purposes or for technological innovation purposes, all of those things have been true. The ability to use software to do great harm to the world already exists. A cyber attack could bring down a piece of critical infrastructure in the United States any day now. And if that does happen, my bet would be that there will be open source software that plays a role in that, in addition to closed source software, probably too. But the point is that the benefits have, even though cyber attacks do happen, the benefits have outweighed the risks. And so I would just have faith in that, to a certain extent, that will continue to be the case, particularly if we allow our law enforcement agencies and, you know, military and intelligence agencies to adapt AI rapidly and creatively so that they can counter many of the threats that are going to emerge either way, regardless of whether or not there's open source software.
That might be a good way to think about it, that, you know, the marginal chance that you know, China is already out there, you know, that adversaries are already out there. It's not like they're not going to have some sort of baseline level of competence, but by enabling sort of random citizens or startups, independent developers, this is a lot of Silicon Valley, you know, a lot of where the innovation actually happens. I was speaking with Steve Hsu just the other day on this, and this is something that I think has historically been America's strength. So looking at it as a way to get the kind of next generation of American talent in a way that I do think is asymmetrical, that is not the same for the next generation of Chinese talent who might be more reliant on, you know, specific structured government funding that, you know, maybe can't use the same open source models, at least when it comes to language models, because they would be, you know, offensive to the Chinese government. They would make Winnie the Pooh jokes and so on. I think that point is true, especially when it comes to cybersecurity, where, you know, you can increase the number of attackers, you can increase the number of defenders, and the probabilities, you know, work out in favor of the defenders, right?
Yeah. What's the one major Western tech platform that has to exist in China for economic reasons? It's GitHub.
Right, right.
Which is where all the open source software libraries are hosted, a company owned by Microsoft, for those who don't know. And people, in fact, you know, there have been examples of people putting subversive messages, you know, for the Chinese population into the code of open source projects on GitHub, because it's the one thing that...
Yeah, the Taiwanese flag emoji, right? This is the meme. Yeah,
other things too,
and or like they draw it out. They draw it out with the ASCII art.
Yeah, and so something that I think, you know, there was a Politico article I was reading this morning called "Can Anyone Control AI?" And it was all about different countries' efforts to regulate AI. And there's this intuitive assumption that people make, which is that the country that sets the best rules for AI will be the country will have a lot of power accrue to it, because everyone will respect their rules. That is not generally how things have worked in the history of technology. The rules for usage and the standards for usage tend to be set by the group of people and the country that invented it. That's true of the internet. The internet is a force, you know, it can be a force for centralized control, but in large part, it is a force for open communication. And I think it's very unlikely that a totalitarian country would have even had the idea to invent such a thing. You know, you think about just many, many technologies that were fundamentally, our conception of them was shaped by the people who invented them. And so I think invention is deeply important in that regard. And I think that open source, because it's communal, there's a global consensus standard making, but it's certainly led by American firms and American developers. It's a tool of soft power that the U.S. would really give up, you know, at great cost, I believe.
Right, right. There's a hypothetical world where we go back to the 60s and we say, you know, all of these great American films. Do we really want, you know, Soviets getting access to these films? Do we really want the Chinese to be able to see these films? What if they copy our techniques? And of course, this would really strip the kind of American vision, you know, blue jeans, grocery stores, so on, which were from, you know, from my historical understanding, at least, which were a kind of historical motivator for people to kind of prefer the American style of life, for that to win out. So this benefit of openness, and yeah, you can argue that already China is trying to stop it, right? They're trying to prevent the Western narratives from going in. There's no reason that we should kind of be the ones to help them out with that.
No, I don't. I think that we need, as a general rule, not just when it comes to software, you know, law, but as a general rule, I think America needs to double down on what makes us different in world history. And to the extent America becomes more like China, I think we're going to lose at that game. I think we will never be able to be better at you know, being China than China. So I suspect we will lose that. So I think we need to double down on what makes America America.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment. Although, before we go, I do want to ask you. So, you know, you write the Hyperdimensional Substack, as well as, you know, contributing to National Affairs. Everyone in the audience should subscribe. You know, it'll be recommended in the notes down below. But why is it the Hyperdimensional Substack? Is it, are the letters going to be popping out of you? Is it, you know, are the articles just expanding into new dimensions as you read them?
Well, so the initial idea was a reference to, you know, hyperdimensional computing, which for those that don't know, AI models are very, very high dimensional in mathematical terms. They might be billions or hundreds of billions of dimension mathematical functions, essentially. So it was a reference to that, but also a reference to the idea of exploring topics, complex topics, from many different angles, many different dimensions, so to speak, and sort of seeing things in a way that is kind of more complicated than what we might intuitively imagine.
Thanks for joining me. This was a great interview. And yeah, I look forward to working with you in the future.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Great to be here.